Today, the scandal engulfing Jeffrey Epstein, the financier who was known for partying with the rich and famous, after a judge ruled that granting him bail would pose a danger to society. And The Guardian's Aditya Chakraborty on the price we pay for billionaire philanthropy. Jeffrey Epstein was one of those wealthy men who seemed to know everybody. Bill Clinton, Donald Trump, Prince Andrew, Woody Allen, Kevin Spacey. The list goes on and on. Epstein threw his friends dinner parties at his New York mansion, flew them on his private plane, and hosted them on his private island. Now he's behind bars. On Thursday, a New York judge ruled that Epstein would not be granted bail after he was charged with sex trafficking in a case that spans decades and reportedly involves hundreds of underage girls. Reporter Vicky Ward was in a courtroom earlier this week when one of Epstein's accusers, Annie Farmer, testified against him.
Well, it was kind of electric in there to watch her stand up and explain to Judge Berman that Jeffrey Epstein had been sexually inappropriate with her at the age of 16 and that it was her strong opinion that Jeffrey Epstein should not be given bail.
There was another shocking moment at the hearing.
I think the other extraordinary moment came when the lawyers for the government announced that they had found in Jeffrey Epstein's New York house an old passport with his face on it, but with a foreign name and registered to Saudi Arabia. They also found dozens of diamonds and piles of cash.
From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, will Jeffrey Epstein's accusers finally get justice?
It's a cliche, but he was a Jay Gatsby type figure. No one knew where his money came from.
Reporter Vicky Ward first crossed paths with Jeffrey Epstein when she was assigned to profile him for Vanity Fair magazine in 2002.
He had an extraordinary Rolodex. Prince Andrew, Bill Clinton, Donald Trump, lots of Nobel Prize winning academics, the lawyer Alan Dershowitz. They would all go to his house, and at the same time, so too were these very young women. And there was a nod and a wink. You know, people said to me, well, who knows what goes on in Jeffrey's personal life? It was just sort of accepted that there were these very young, very attractive women at his parties.
And Epstein declined to be interviewed for your profile at the time.
So Jeffrey Epstein had never been exposed to a magazine profile, any kind of media profile, really, before, quite deliberately. So he was very aggressive in the way he handled me right from the moment that I phoned his offices and said, I'm going to be doing this profile, basically, whether you participate or not.
He wouldn't speak with you on the record, but he did want you to see his house. What was it like?
First thing that you see when you come into this hallway, you have this enormous sculpture towering over you, and you turn around and there are all these eyeballs that he said, you know, they were made for wounded soldiers in the war. I mean, it's quite unnerving. He took me up to what most people would consider a living room. He called an office. There was one book left out, you know, by the Marquis de Sade. There was a stuffed poodle, black stuffed poodle on the top of the grand piano. And he said, you know, I have that out here because I want people to think what it means to stuff a dog. I mean, it's proudly told me that the Persian carpet was so big, it must have come from a mosque. You know, the way he bragged about his possessions was very crass and quite unusual for people who have a lot of money in this town.
What was his kind of early career? I mean, you were reporting on his finances. Do you know how he got so rich?
How he claims he got so rich is just not true. It doesn't make any sense, this notion that he put out that he's a money manager to unnamed billionaires from whom he takes a cut. And the reason that makes no sense is that people who run hedge funds or who trade leave a footprint in the markets. No one in the hedge fund world ever heard of Jeffrey Epstein. He was chucked out of Bear Stearns. You know, we now know from all the indictments over the last two decades that he spent a large amount of his time getting massages from women, some of whom were underage. So, you know, where were the hours in the day to do any work? The whole thing is still really a great mystery.
I mean, it sounds like a house of cards.
You know, as I discovered more and more, he did go on to be mentored by a man named Steve Hoffenberg, who I went to meet with in jail. Steve Hoffenberg went to prison in the 1990s for masterminding what was then the largest Ponzi scheme in American history, pre-Bernie Madoff. Not only had I met with Steve Hoffenberg, who had a lot to say, I'd also gone and got hold of a lot of these depositions. And I think that that was the first time anybody had ever done that. And I had got these two sisters who were on the record, as was their mother, who claimed that he had molested them, one of them when she was only 16, Annie Farmer, who went on the record in the court. He turned nasty. And that's when he went in to see Graydon Carter, the editor, I guess to make his case. I mean, one of the fact checkers wrote to me, oh my God, there is Jeffrey Epstein in Graydon's office right now as we speak.
Is that why those details didn't make it into the final piece?
All I know is that Graydon told me that he believed Jeffrey because he was Canadian, which seemed a bit of a non sequitur. And I was then told actually by my line editor that the piece was stronger as a financial piece.
So they cut out what you had written?
Yeah.
How did you feel when that was cut out of your piece?
I burst into tears in the middle of the office, which is not something I make a habit of, but I felt that they had been so brave that we'd really nailed it. We had got the proof. They were on the record. I thought it was preposterous. Really preposterous. I went back to them and I asked them what they wanted to do. And they said, well, this is exactly what we were afraid of, that Jeffrey Epstein's money and influence, you know, speaks louder than we do. No one will believe us. So they wanted to drop it. And I didn't blame them.
It wasn't just the farmers. Other girls and young women continued to make allegations against Epstein. In 2006, authorities began investigating and he served a short jail sentence. But the details were murky and the voices of the victims were not heard. Until, in 2017, Miami Herald reporter Julie Brown tracked down Epstein's accusers and interviewed them. They all told very similar stories.
I remember there was a staircase, kind of like a spiral almost.
And she brings us up the stairs, and it was like spiral stairs.
You walked into his bedroom to a very little hall, and then it was another door, and that's where everything would happen. He would have a dresser, and it was filled with like lotion and sex toys.
And then he came in with his white towel on around him.
And then he just laid down in his towel on his stomach, and he was just talking to people on the phone. When he flipped over, that's when he said, okay, you can go ahead and take off your shirt and pants, but you can stay in your underwear.
He would want us to stand next to him, and he would masturbate while he stared at us, touched us.
It ended with sexual abuse and intercourse, and then a pat on the back. You've done a really good job. You know, thank you very much, and here's $200. You know, before you know it, I'm being lent out to politicians and to academics and to people that you, royalty.
One survivor described how Epstein deliberately preyed on girls who were homeless or otherwise vulnerable. He allegedly paid some of them to recruit others, building a network of victims to exploit. The thing that had sparked Brown's interest in the case was Donald Trump's appointment of Alexander Acosta as Labour Secretary, the same man who was involved in the original prosecution as Florida Attorney General. Ed Pilkington, you're chief reporter at Guardian US, and you've been following this story. There was still a lot of secrecy around the plea deal that Acosta had arranged with Epstein. As a result of Brown's reporting, we now know much more about it. What were the details of the deal?
Well, the details are pretty shocking. They were negotiated between 2007 and 2008, and actually the deal was reached in 2008. And as you say, this guy, Alexander Acosta, he was head of the federal prosecutors in Florida. And in this case, Acosta reached a deal that was really shockingly lenient. People call it a sweetheart deal because it was sort of so sweet for Epstein. And there were two elements of it that were particularly shocking. One involved an amnesty for Epstein himself and for any of his co-conspirators. We don't know the actual names of the people they were thinking about, but it was plural. It was co-conspirators, plural. And it said that they essentially were no longer to be prosecuted by the feds. And we know that by that time, the FBI had been investigating Jeffrey Epstein for at least a year, and they had actually a draft indictment together, which was 53 pages long and involved at least 35 mainly underage girls. So they basically had the raps on this guy, and yet they gave him immunity from prosecution. And the other thing that shocked people even more was they reached this deal in secret. And by secret, I particularly mean that they didn't tell any of the victims or their families about what they were about to do, which was to drop all the federal charge indictment against Epstein and his co-conspirators, and instead go for two much lesser, weaker charges brought by the state of Florida. And those charges had Epstein soliciting prostitutes. Now, you have to think about that for a minute. They were calling underage girls prostitutes, which in itself is deeply offensive. And actually, you cannot be a prostitute if you're underage. You can be sexually assaulted, you can be raped, but you cannot be a prostitute if you're underage.
Absolutely. Acosta is a name that is very familiar to us now. I mean, who was he?
At the time, he was this top US prosecutor in Florida. After that, he went on to be nominated by President Trump as his labor secretary. And that's a very powerful job within the federal government.
How was the deal reached?
What we know from incredible journalistic work done by Miami Herald was that a team of US prosecutors and a team of Jeffrey Epstein's crack lawyers led by Alan Dershowitz and including Ken Starr, you may remember Ken Starr, he happened to be the guy who went after Bill Clinton over the Monica Lewinsky affair. You've got a very scary team of top lawyers whose business is to basically bully people into accepting deals that are favorable to their clients. But on the other side, you had the federal prosecutors led by Alexander Acosta and his team of prosecutors. And Miami Herald got hold of sort of emails between the two parties. And the federal prosecutors are incredibly chummy. The language is like the language of mates. And they kind of bend over backwards to try and help Jeffrey Epstein, basically. When they come to the plea deal, they say, well, let's bring it in Miami and not in Palm Beach, where Jeffrey Epstein had his mansion house, because that way the media won't notice and there'll be less press coverage. And that was the prosecutor saying it. So there was a kind of bad smell around the whole thing, really, in terms of just how cozy it all was.
Some say Jeffrey Epstein got off easy when he agreed to a plea deal that left him in jail for 13 months today.
Now, Acosta, when he tried to save his job as Labor Secretary last week, he gave a big press conference and he claimed that he did everything he did in order to get Jeffrey Epstein behind bars.
In 2006, a grand jury recommended a single charge, and that charge would have resulted in no jail time at all, no registration as a sexual offender, and no restitution to the victim.
And he said it was the only thing he could possibly do. This was the best deal he could possibly reach.
These cases, as I said, are hard.
And we know what happened as a result. He went in on an 18-month sentence. He served 13 of those months. And during those 13 months, we know that 6 days out of seven, he came out of the gates of the jail. He was met by his driver in a very nice limousine, and he was driven to his plush, luxurious business offices where he spent 12 hours of the day. It left a lot of bad taste in the mouth, I think, for a lot of people about what exactly had gone here. And of course, not least for the victims and their families. The first they knew of this deal, because it had been done in secret, was that they read it in the papers. You know, the secrecy of it, I think, was one of the things that did for Acosta in the end, because just this February, he and his prosecutorial team were found by a federal judge to have acted illegally.
Well, a federal judge in Florida has ruled prosecutors, including current Labor Secretary Alex Acosta, violated federal law when they reached a plea agreement in 2007 with financier and sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. The judge says they also failed to inform dozens of his victims.
Because by failing to tell victims what they were doing and coming up with this sweetheart deal, they had broken the law that exists, which obliges prosecutors to inform victims of what they're doing, so that victims, in advance of the deal being finalized, can have their say and say, no, I don't approve of this. I don't think this is right. And yet, one of the reasons they kept it secret, one assumes, is in order to deprive victims of that opportunity and also to keep the press away. Along came the Miami Herald and its incredible, intrepid reporter, Julie Brown, who began investigating in 2017 after Acosta was confirmed as Labor Secretary.
As I administer the oath of office to the 27th Secretary of Labor for the United States of America, Alexander Acosta.
That kind of drew her attention to the story. She just followed her instincts. She started investigating it, and she started finding the victims. And she eventually, by the time she'd finished, she published in November 2018, she had managed to find about 80 victims, many, many of whom were underage at the time. And she persuaded 8 of them to tell their stories. And that's what really blew the gasket on this whole thing and basically lost Acosta his job.
And in the meantime, Epstein went to jail. What happened when he was released in 2009?
So, yeah, he came out of prison in 2009 and just took up his life as before. We now know he just carried on.
Carried on with what? I mean, carried on hanging out with his famous associates?
Certainly no. He carried on hanging out with his rich and powerful chums on his private jet, hanging out on his island in New Mexico and his mansion in New York. Rich and powerful friends who included Ghislaine Maxwell, the daughter of the disgraced media tycoon from Britain, who some say was a procurer of girls for him, allegedly. There was Prince Andrew, who he'd been friendly with for a while, and we know that Prince Andrew attended a dinner with Epstein in 2010, a year after he'd come out of jail.
And in 2015, Prince Andrew was embroiled in more controversy when one of Epstein's accusers claimed that she was forced to have sex with Andrew when she was 17, a charge he vehemently denies.
Britain's Prince Andrew has been named in an ongoing lawsuit in America and accused of having sex with a minor during meetings organised by former Wall Street wizard Jeffrey Epstein.
Those claims emerged because in the intervening years, Epstein faced several civil lawsuits. He was able to use his wealth to settle a number of cases, and it wasn't until this year that things really changed, as evidence collected made way for criminal charges.
When the Southern District of New York prosecutors went to pick him up about 10 days ago, they raided his New York mansion, and they found lots of underage photographs and stuff on his computers. And also, a chilling detail that struck me, they also found the massage room in his New York mansion set up in exactly the same way as it had been 15 years ago. We don't know whether he's been using it, so let's be clear about that. But it's just the idea that he came out and was a reformed character after 13 months hanging out all day long in his luxury offices. The idea that he came out a different person is pretty implausible.
Earlier this month, prosecutors from the Southern District of New York announced a slew of new charges against Epstein.
Good morning. I'm Jeff Berman, United States Attorney for the Southern District of New York. Today, we announce the unsealing of sex trafficking charges against Jeffrey Epstein. The charges allege that Epstein sexually abused young girls by enticing them to engage in sex acts for money.
How are these charges different from the original charges filed in Florida?
The SDNY have gone for sex trafficking indictments. One is a sex trafficking conspiracy, and the other is a just pure sex trafficking network. And I just think the language of that, compared with soliciting prostitutes, suggests that they're taking this, finally taking this seriously. And sex trafficking is a sort of hold-all expression that allows you to pack in a number of different crimes and is kind of basically going to allow them to go wherever they feel like, go wherever their investigation takes them.
It's interesting because Trump has associated himself with a number of people who we would think were unsavory, perhaps. But not Epstein. He has tried to distance himself from him, despite them having a relationship in the past. I mean, what do we know about their relationship?
Well, we know that Trump has praised him in the past. He called him a terrific guy. And he actually referred to Epstein having a wonderful social life, including a lot of younger women hanging out with him. Palm Beach, where Trump has his a major base, was also one of Epstein's main hangouts with his mansion house in Palm Beach. And that's where a lot of the alleged sex crimes took place. One of the stories that have emerged is that in 1992, calendar girl competition was arranged at Trump's request, apparently, in which some 28 women were flown into Mar-a-Lago. And the person who was asked to organize the event was extremely surprised to find that the only two people in the audience for that calendar girl event were going to be Jeffrey Epstein and Donald Trump. Now, since they had a falling out at a time around, I think, around 2005, 2006. We don't know what specifically happened around that falling out. And since then, Trump has been very active trying to push Epstein away from himself, including since Epstein's arrest. He says, we don't get on. I don't like the guy. He's not my kind of guy. You know, he's been saying all those Trump-like things.
Okay, anybody else?
Jeffrey Epstein is a terrific guy.
Well, I knew him like everybody in Palm Beach knew him. I mean, I had a falling out with him a long time ago. I don't think I've spoken to him for 15 years. I wasn't a fan. I was not a fan of his, that I can tell you. I was not a fan of his. So
yes, he tried to put as much space between himself and Epstein as possible. But, you know, Trump did have a social relationship with Epstein.
A tape in the NBC archives of a Mar-a-Lago party shows Trump giving Epstein his personal attention.
And that's going to continue, I think, to cause him a bit of trouble.
Where is Epstein right now?
So Epstein is in a central federal jail in New York. Of course, he's pleaded not guilty to the charges. And at this stage, you know, everything that's said against him is at the state of allegations.
And if he's convicted, he could face up to 45 years in prison.
Yes, at the age of 66, that would bring him up to the age of 109 by my math. So yes, he's in quite a lot of legal peril at the moment.
Vicky, do you wish you'd done anything differently in 2002?
I don't know what else I could have done. I felt I reported, I had the reporting rock solid. I asked Maria and Annie and their mother, Janice, what shall we do now? And they didn't want to get involved.
Do you think the farmers have been able to find their voice because of the Me Too movement?
Yes. Well, I think not just the Me Too movement, but I think that the fact that Jeffrey Epstein is now, you know, in obviously in an extremely different position than he was all those years ago, I think that they feel that for the first time they're going to be taken seriously.
Where does it end? What needs to happen next?
Well, you know, I think this is global, actually.
In what way?
Well, I think it's, you know, the very fact that they found that foreign passport. We've already had in 2015, you had a French model agency owner bring a case against him because he felt his reputation was being tarnished by association with Jeffrey Epstein. The fact that Jeffrey Epstein has got a photograph of the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia in his house and is known to be have given financial advice, whatever that means, to various potentates in the Middle East. And the fact that the people, the web of people around him are so influential. When somebody like Jeffrey Epstein is in this kind of trouble he is, that's when influential people start to protect themselves. By that I mean that they may start to talk about what really went on.
Vicky, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
That was Vicky Ward and Ed Pilkington. Do follow this story at theguardian.com. Coming up, how charity works for Notre Dame's mega donors. Now, around the world, cultural landmarks are increasingly dependent on the deep pockets of the super rich. And for The Guardian's Aditya Chakraborty, these charitable donations are less give and more take.
Cast your mind back to mid-April. The news suddenly comes in. One of the world's most ancient and holy buildings, the Notre Dame Cathedral, has gone up in flames. And for once in these divided times, the world is unified by horror at what they see. The adjectives rain down. It is atrocious, it is terrible, it is diabolical. And then within hours, with the flames barely out, some of the richest people in France are coming forward with offers to help rebuild this piece of world heritage. So you get the Arnault family. Arnault is the richest man in Europe coming forward, and they put down 100 million euros. And then, not to be outdone, you get the Pinault family coming forward, and they do 200. And then you get the various families and foundations around L'Oreal, and they come forward with 200. Which, on one hand, is this magnificent gesture. And on the other hand, obviously raises some questions. You know, why the professional malcontents like me asked at the time, why did all this plutocratic piety have to be so earnestly press released? Why, when there are nearly 4,000 rough sleepers on the streets of Paris, why can a roof be found for a church but not for humans? Anyway, the front pages are filled and then the world moves on. And what happens next is worth thinking about. It turns out that the super rich donors who'd put their press releases out had been somewhat slow with the checks. In mid-June, most of the money so far had come in much humbler sums from people who were much poorer. Now, as time's gone by, there has been a little bit of money from the Arnaults and the Pinaults, but nowhere near the vast sums that were promised back in April. There are four charities which coordinate the sums given to Notre Dame, and one of the charity executives says, well, the big donors are waiting to see the government's vision for the rebuilding of the Notre Dame, and when they see the vision, they'll decide what to fund. Now, as it happens, in any big rebuilding project after a massive disaster like the Notre Dame Inferno, there's always a massive cleanup that needs to be done. Huge amount of grunt work. And at the moment, there's 150 workers who need their salaries paid. But as one of the officials points out, rich people don't want their money to go on poor people's salaries. Because after all, how photogenic are the labouring classes? What plaque is going to go by where a bunch of lead contamination was cleaned up? No, they would much rather, one might speculate, donate towards the Basilica, as brought to you by Gucci, or even a nave brought to you by L'Oreal, because Jesus is worth it. The point is, this epic generosity nearly always hides a much harder bargain. The super rich give, but they also take. They give money, but they take power from the rest of society. They get to say which bit of the blueprint they like or don't like. They don't hand over the money without any conditions. My solid bet is that all those much poorer individuals have handed over the money with no questions asked. And that is the way charity works for most of us, but not at the really top levels.
That was Aditya Chakraborty. My thanks to him and to Vicky Ward and Ed Pilkington. That's all for today. This episode was produced by Mithili Rao and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. Have a lovely weekend, and we'll be back on Monday.